Of America, time now for International Edition. Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. Officials in Cameroon say Boko Haram militants have abducted at least 60 people in a cross-border raid from Nigeria. Government spokeswoman Issa Chiroma says three people were killed, 80 homes destroyed in Sunday's raid, which targeted villages in Cameroon's far north region. The Reuters news agency cites a senior army officer saying the majority of those kidnapped are children between the ages of 10 and 15. The raid came a day after Chad sent thousands of troops into Cameroon to help fight Boko Haram, which has been seizing territory along the Nigerian-Cameroonian border and recently took control of a military base near the shores of Lake Chad. Cameroon's military says the soldiers will be deployed to the north in the war zone on the Nigerian border. Meanwhile, a suicide bomber has killed at least four and wounded at least 25 others in the northern Nigerian city of Potiskum. Local police say the bomber detonated a car filled with explosives at a bus station early Sunday. No immediate claim of responsibility, but suspicion does fall on Boko Haram, which often targets bus stations and other public gathering spots.
Somalia's prime minister has dissolved his 60-man cabinet on the day it was to face a confidence vote in the federal parliament. The prime minister has 14 days to propose a new cabinet and seek a confidence vote in the divided parliament. Abdulaziz Bello reports on the latest political developments in Somalia.
Somalia parliament members voiced strong opposition to the cabinet proposed by Somali Prime Minister Omar Abdirashid Ali Sharmake, and he withdrew his list of 60 appointees just hours before a confidence vote in the country's top lawmaking body. The Prime Minister also called for parliament to grant him a 14-day extension to form an administration. Through his spokesman, Mr. Sharmake thanked the 275-member parliament for heeding his request.
The Prime Minister has given enough thoughts to the issues raised by Somali lawmakers, and after careful consideration, he will announce a competent government that will have both the support of the Somali parliament and the Somali public.
Political analyst Abubakar Albedri says Mr. Sharmake is likely to face many challenges from the Somali parliament before his cabinet list is endorsed.
The prime minister is facing a daunting task. He is faced with dealing with a divided parliament and strong opposition of his cabinet appointees by several clans. MPs and clan elders have also voiced concern over the recent appointments, and this might derail the prime minister from delivering on his duties.
Among the problems that lawmakers had with Mr. Sharmake's list was the inclusion of former ministers and senior officials previously accused of incompetency. Experts say parliament's decision to reject the appointees indicates the maturity of Somalia's democratic institutions.
The parliament in this case has shown its credibility by turning down the cabinet appointees even before it was brought to parliament. This shows that if the administration does not cooperate with the parliament, endorsing the future government lists might prove more complicated in the future.
The East African nation has taken steps towards order after years of lawlessness, but a political crisis developed late last year when President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud forced the resignation of the then Prime Minister Abdiweli Sheikh Ahmed. The political instability is threatening the country's plan for elections in 2016. The international community remains committed to stabilizing Somalia, but United Nations and U.S. officials have demanded the country's leaders halt their chronic infighting for the sake of Somalia's future. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
From the Voice of America in Washington, this is International Edition. Recent terrorist attacks in Paris have dominated political rhetoric worldwide over this past week. U.S. President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron discussed cooperation against the growing terrorist threat by radicalized Islamists during a meeting in Washington Friday. While police in several European countries conducted raids on suspected terrorist cells, groups of Muslims in a number of countries held rallies protesting against what they see as insults and assaults against Islam. Shalada Kahok has more.
European countries have boosted security in the wake of Paris terrorist attacks. The head of the European Union police agency, Europol, said international cooperation is essential as extremists move across borders and use increasingly sophisticated methods. He said a great number of European Muslims have become radicalized and armed.
We're also concerned about the way in which terrorist networks are using the internet in a much more sophisticated way, as a recruitment tool, as a propaganda tool, as we have seen with IS in Syria. But we're particularly concerned about the way in which the internet, of course, can be used for effective, secure communications outside perhaps the reach of law enforcement.
In Washington Friday, President Obama and Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron agreed to expand cooperation on fighting terrorism.
We both recognize that intelligence and military force alone is not going to solve this problem, so we're also going to keep working together on strategies to counter violent extremism that radicalizes, recruits, and mobilizes people, especially young people, to engage in terrorism. And local communities, families, neighbors, faith leaders have a vital role to play in that effort.
Ahead of the meeting, Prime Minister Cameron told the Associated Press he would seek cooperation with large technology firms to allow governments access to highly suspicious encrypted communications.
There is a broad agreement that we need to have the powers to, in extremis, intercept communications between terrorists. That is what America does today. It is what Britain does today. We share the intelligence and information between us. And this has saved countless lives, not just in Britain and America, but in other countries as well.
Meanwhile, in Ghana, President John Mahama called on African nations to work together to rid the continent permanently of the threat of terror.
I am, through the President of ECOWAS, requesting a special session at the upcoming 24th African Union Summit in order to discuss and plan, not as separate sub-regions, but as one united continent, the way forward in our collective fight against terrorism.
The week after the attacks on the French magazine Charlie Hebdo, the satirical weekly published a new issue with the cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad on its cover, sparking several protests around the world, some of which turned violent. Slavica Ho, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Secret Service says multiple gunshots were fired from a vehicle passing near the Delaware home of U.S. Vice President Joe Biden late Saturday. The shots were fired from a public road outside of his home's security perimeter. Officials say the incident took place at about 8:25 p.m. local time from a vehicle traveling at a high rate of speed. About 30 minutes later, an individual in a vehicle was arrested after attempting to pass a county police officer securing the perimeter. Officials say that person was not involved in the shooting. With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson. That's International Edition on VOA Global.
This is International Business News from the Voice of America. With Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. Swiss officials sought to reassure their country Sunday that a shock decision by the central bank to scrap its cap on the franc would not destabilize the economy ahead of a crucial week in which the European Central Bank could announce a massive bond buying program. The finance minister, Eveline Widnier-Schlumpf, said that she expects the exchange rate to settle down at around 1.10 per euro, a level she believes firms in the support-oriented country should be able to withstand. The Swiss National Bank stunned markets Thursday when it abandoned its three-year-old cap on the franc of 1.20 per euro, saying that policy had become unsustainable. The move sent the franc soaring, prompting firms across Switzerland to warn of a plunge in profits, with the luxury, industrial, and tourism sectors most exposed.
The central bank in Greece has moved to protect its banks from any fallout from the coming general election, asking the European Central Bank to approve a standby domestic emergency funding line, according to a Bank of Greece official. That move comes after two major banks applied to be able to tap an emergency liquidity assistance window on Friday as Greeks withdrew cash before the snap election on January 25th. Greece's radical left-wing Syriza party is leading in the polls. It wants to end austerity and renegotiate debt with its European partners.
The governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, is expected to announce his in the State of the State address on Wednesday that he will lead a trade mission to Cuba in the coming months, according to a person familiar with his plans. Trip by the second-term Democratic governor would be among the first by a high-profile U.S. politician since the Obama administration loosened travel and trade rules for the country.
That's a look at business on VOA Global.
Are you ready for a visit to the American Cafe?
I am indeed, as always at this time.
Well, we have kind of opposites coming up. The most populous city in the country, New York, dealing with transportation, and also one of the most scantily populated, shall I say that, the town in Kansas, about what they're doing toward their situation with not enough water to sustain their agriculture. All that coming up now on VOA. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. A record number of Americans are moving into cities and, at the same time, curbing their driving habits. No better example than New York City. VOA's Bernard Schussman visits the cafe with the story.
3.4 billion riders on New York City subways and buses a year. This amazing number equals one-third of all mass transit trips in the United States. Ridership is at its highest in almost 60 years in almost every American city. A commuter advocacy group, Straphanger's Campaign, attributes it to younger Americans, says Gene Rushinoff.
Millennials, those people born around the turn of this past century, are much less car-oriented.
In addition to millennials, many people believe public transit is economical and eco-friendly. In 2012, across America, people took 10.7 billion trips. New York is not standing still, as passenger demand requires several major expansion projects. A new $4.5 billion subway line on New York's Second Avenue will take an overload of passengers off of other subway lines. Its first phase completion is scheduled in 2016. And probably the most controversial and costly project is a $7 billion tunnel connection from Long Island into Manhattan's Grand Central Terminal. Trains from there will have access to New York's Midtown Business District. Andrew Albert, a board member of the Metropolitan Transit Authority, says there are many other reasons the public is riding in increasing numbers.
The system has gotten a lot more dependable. We have new cars. We have countdown clocks to tell you when the next trains are coming. We have expanded facilities in places.
New York's 24-hour, 7-day-a-week transit system costs $1.5 billion a year to maintain. It is one of the world's oldest, with its first subway line having opened in 1904. Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
We go from the most populous city in the United States, New York, to one of its least populated, a farming community in western Kansas. Young people have been leaving areas like this as the business of the area, agriculture, dries up along with a diminishing supply of what is the lifeblood of farming, water. Kane Farabaugh visited Colby, Kansas.
Mitchell Ballman's farm outside Hoxie, Kansas, is about as rural as you can get.
Kind of out here by ourselves, you know, not a lot of populace.
And not a lot of rain due to a prolonged drought.
We were the eternal optimist of farmers out here in western Kansas, so we always think it's going to get better.
Ballman farms land that has been in his family for four generations. His father was born during the infamous Dust Bowl in the 1930s, when the farmland dried out, dusted up, and drove people away. But what makes the current drought different from the Dust Bowl at the Ballman family farm is the Ogallala Aquifer. Out in the heart of his wheat fields, an industrial pump draws water out of a well tapped into the massive underground aquifer. The water reaches an above-ground pivot system that slowly moves in a circular pattern over the planted crops. Ballman says it is a major improvement over the old pipe systems that used to flood the farmland.
10 years ago, we might have averaged 700 to 800 gallon per minute wells. Today, we're probably averaging 400.
Ballman is proud of those figures. He is keenly aware that the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer could ultimately drive his family off the land.
I started realizing the importance of water when I realized that my boys and everybody else's kids want to move back to these small towns. So to keep bringing the populace back to our small communities, we have to have the water.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Colby, Kansas.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Come on in every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Author and feminist Vera Brittain's memoir of love and loss during World War I, Testament of Youth, comes to the screen with Swedish actress Alicia Vikander and Game of Thrones star Kit Harington in the leads. The story, based on Brittain's best-selling book of the same title, tells how Vera, her brother Edward, and his friends Roland Lytton and Victor Richardson enjoy one last summer together before all are pulled into the Great War. One by one, the characters meet with tragedy. Brittain's fiancé, wartime poet Roland Lytton, played by Kit Harington, and their two friends are killed. Vera Brittain, who had aspired to be a writer and had been accepted to studies at Oxford, becomes a battlefield nurse's aide and serves in several of the theaters of war. Vera Brittain's daughter, Shirley Williams, is now a liberal member of Britain's upper house of parliament. She told the Associated Press that her mother felt compelled to trade the safety of Oxford studies for the hardships of war.
My mother, therefore, decided after about 6 months that she simply couldn't bear to be in a kind of ivory tower studying, and decided that she had to get as close as she possibly could to the front and the things that they were going through. And that meant that she volunteered to work as what was called a voluntary aid detachment nurse. We'd nowadays call it an assistant health worker, probably, but they were called assistant nurses at that time.
Shirley Williams says that working as a nurse's aide helped her mother cope with the devastating pain she endured.
I think in a way that she saw working in hospital as a kind of cauterizing of the agony. She was so numbed by the work she did, the hours she did, the endless awfulness of dealing with things like gangrene, gassing, floods of casualties lying on the floor among the blood. In a way, I think it made it possible for her to continue because she thought of nothing but work. She devoted herself to nothing but work. And it was a kind of anesthetic of a strange kind.
Alicia Vikander, who plays Vera in the film, says that the shooting schedule was a grueling one and she relied very heavily on her ensemble castmates to get through it.
I wanted to, make justice to this woman, and it is a lot of emotional scenes. But, I had all Taryn and Kit and Colin and Dominic and Emily and, of course, James, the director, and they were such a great support throughout the film, and, yeah, we made it.
Director James Kent says that Vikander brought exactly what he was looking for to the role, vulnerability and strength that Vera Brittain had modeled in life.
You know, she has great luminosity in her face. She has great emotional intuition. And at the same time, she's incredibly beautiful. And you just want to watch her and her reactions. Incredibly subtle. Maybe that's the Swedish side of her. She brings this quite nuanced acting style, but a bit like Ingrid Bergman. You know, there's something just gorgeousness about her. And I think, she makes Vera her own.
Kit Harington told the AP that it was important to show how the war affected not only the troops on the front, but also those on the home side.
And that's what Vera Brittain's book, it helps us see more than anything else, is that side of the war. It's those women who lost all of their brothers and their loved ones and their fathers, and it's about the people left behind, really. And actually, in this film, we only go to the trenches in flashbacks or in little pieces of memory. We don't spend much time at the front.
Vera Brittain eventually went on to write two more autobiographies, Testament of Friendship and Testament of Experience. She married in 1925 and had two children. She also became known for her pacifism and her feminism. Testament of Youth also stars Welsh actor Taron Egerton as Vera's brother Edward Brittain, veteran actor Dominic West as her father, and Emily Watson as her mother. Testament of Youth was filmed on location in England and was released in Britain in mid-January. So, what do you think? Do you plan to see Testament of Youth? Let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
While you're busy telling David Byrd what you think, why don't you also ask for a 2015 VOA calendar? It's really easy.
What do you think about that?
Yeah. That's a good idea. I think you should have it.
Yeah, we might miss January. You know, it takes a little while to get to you, but you can get it.
You might not have Miss January, but you'll have Miss February, Miss March. No.
If you like rock formations in the American Southwest.
That's right.
And they're gorgeous. They're beautiful pictures.
Send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com, and include your postal mailing address.
That's the sound we make when we're ready to tell you about sports.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the sound, and our Pavlovian response is to read sports to you. France's Gary Stahl dispatched the final round 65 to snatch an unlikely victory at the Abu Dhabi HSBC Golf Championship Sunday in Abu Dhabi. Nick Dye has the story from the course.
Stahl finds it hard to believe he's won, though he arrived in good form after a top-five finish in South Africa, and he'd played well all week. He fired birdie after birdie in an aggressive yet controlled performance, but an early glance at a leaderboard had seen Kaimer moving to 23 under par. The US Open champion was six clear at the start of the final day. He'd won in Abu Dhabi on three occasions. He was bound to win again. And yet a double bogey at 9 was followed by a triple at 13. Suddenly, Stahl led and the race was wide open. McIlroy's closing 66 meant runner-up for the fourth time in the event. Kaimer was in shock, back in third. Stahl looked shell-shocked himself with all the sudden attention at winning such a big title against a star-studded field. From world number 357, he'll see plenty of doors opening now. He's in the top 100.
Australian golfer Robert Allenby, meanwhile, was recovering Saturday from facial injuries after he was kidnapped, beaten, robbed, and dumped in a park in Honolulu. The 43-year-old Allenby was in Hawaii to compete in the Sony Open at the Wailea Country Club in Honolulu. He missed the cut and was planning to fly home Saturday, according to the Golf Channel.
American Lindsey Vonn equaled Austrian Anna Maria Moser-Proel's 35-year-old record of 62 women's alpine skiing World Cup victories when she won a downhill in Cortina d'Ampezzo on Sunday. The four-time World Cup overall winner and 2010 Olympic champion, who returned to action this season after a year out due to knee operations, can now break the record in Monday's Super G in the same Italian resort.
Novak Djokovic pronounced himself fit and raring to go in search of his fifth Australian Open title Sunday after he overcame a bout of illness that had prompted social media users to suggest he was in doubt for the tournament. Djokovic had canceled a practice session and a news conference on Saturday. That's sports on VOA Global.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Most robots being used today to perform various tasks, even very simple functions, require extensive and detailed programming by humans, something that can be a long and arduous process. But Dr. Yanis Alimonos, along with his colleagues at the University of Maryland Institute for Advanced Computer Studies, have been developing robots that can teach themselves various kitchen skills simply by having them watch cooking videos on YouTube. The concept that you and your colleagues have been working on seems to skip these traditional programming steps and instead are actually teaching, as you could humans, to perform functions.
Exactly. By having the robot looking at humans performing an action, if you have the right formulation, you can get the robot to learn those particular actions and to do it itself.
Along with mechanical functions to do the actual work, there is also the robot's brain, which is usually some type of computer. Using teaching methods, however, the robot needs to be able to see and hear and also be able to comprehend and replicate human-type functions. Now, how are these robots that you and your colleagues working on equipped to be able to do this?
Actually, this is what we mostly work on. We work on the brain of the computer and on the vision of the robot. Because, as you well know and you have seen, Many people have made robots that can pick up something and move it or perform some kind of a task. What we did is we managed to piece together all these different atomic movements into actions that make sense. So in order to do that, the robot has to be able to see the hands of the person, track the hands of the person, understand the tools that the hands are holding, understand the relationship between the tools and the objects, and recognize the consequences of actions.
So why are you using YouTube videos to do this, which vary from those that are well-written and produced to those that have bad audio video quality and may be poorly produced to teach these robots and not specifically produced videos that could provide much more detailed instructions?
We could do that. However, the ability to have a robot go into the internet and, you know, look at a number of videos and understand the actions opens new horizons in our field, because you can imagine robots taking advantage of the internet and what exists in there as a knowledge base which they can use in order to learn how to perform actions. And in our experiments, we used cooking videos. Cooking is an example, because cooking is as hard as anything that you can do with your hands. So we used cooking videos from YouTube. So as a result, then, if the robot is looking at cooking videos, it's learning how to do the same actions, which amount to cooking.
What kind of progress has your team made so far? What can your robots actually do right now?
Oh, our robots can learn a number of actions that involve tools and objects, but the relationship should not be too complex. So in other words, in the way computer science is phrasing this, the grammar, so to speak, that we build for the actions, they are context-free. While there may be actions that are depending on context, or what we call context-sensitive. So for the most part, the robots can perform actions that involve objects and effect of tools on those objects, like cutting or putting together, assembling or moving things.
And finally, Professor, how close are we to having intelligent robots helping us in our kitchens cooking our meals?
We are actually very close. As far as having robots in our kitchens cooking our meals, that will take a little longer, I suspect. But we are much closer to intelligent robots that will be working and helping humans in the new smart manufacturing environments of the immediate future.
That was Dr. Yannis Alimonos from the University of Maryland Institute for Advanced Computer Studies in College Park, Maryland. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. Please visit us on the internet at voanews.com/science.
So here's a joke. Not really a joke. A guy is delivering pizza.
Mm.
It's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. College town. Great college town in Michigan, where the University of Michigan is. There is a meeting of real estate agents, people who make a lot of money for the most part. They surprised this pizza delivery guy. He delivered one pizza to them, and they gave him a tip for $2,084.
How did they decide the $84?
It was probably the change from the pizza. Maybe they gave him a $3,000 bill. Then the guy, the delivery guy, Rob, said, "All I did was deliver pizza." Well, the agents from the realtor company all pitched in while attending the company's regional conference. Said they wanted to show their appreciation to someone from the service industry.
Hey, he also got a Visa gift card, lottery tickets, and even letters of encouragement. Now there's something you can bank on.
Go deliver your pizza. No, it's a nice thing they did.
It is.
Then I don't know if we told you this story or not, but there was a sheriff's department in Pinellas County, Florida, and they had a rug made for their police station, and it was supposed to say "In God We Trust,"
mm-hmm.
but somebody messed up, and it came out in "Dog We Trust."
Hey, that's kind of cool.
It is. So you know what they're going to do?
What?
Why don't you tell me? Oh, they're gonna. It's a green rug.
You're asking me. What are they doing?
They're gonna auction it off. Okay. And they're giving the money to a local animal rights group called Canine Estates. So, again, somebody doing the right
thing.
Very
appropriate. Very nice.
That'll wrap it up for this Monday edition of VOA Global. Let's see. Carl Starling is pushing the buttons. Diane Gao is standing there with her arms folded. She's the boss.
Managing editor.
Yeah, and Tracy Carter is ordering us around.
Oh,
have yourself a wonderful day.
Bye.